You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Local 41 and United Auto Workers Local 31. Teamsters Local 41 is the largest Teamster local in Kansas City and the surrounding area, and it represents approximately 6,000 members in many industries, including freight, UPS, dairy, food and beverage, bakery, warehouse, car haul, car dealers, car rental, parking, and show work. We help workers and their families achieve and live the American dream. Our members are hardworking, patriotic, caring, family-oriented, and civic-minded. And we proudly support our men and women in uniform that put their lives on the line every day to protect our rights and freedom. And UAW Local 31 says, buy American, keep America working. They build the Chevy Malibu and the Buick LaCrosse at the GM Fairfax plant. What you drive, drives America. We thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, it's all about bullies. They're on the playground, in our homes, in the workplace, and in government. Is bullying on the rise, or are we just more willing to name it and stand up against it? Tonight, we look at the workplace workplace bullying and how to fight back. In the news, IMF admits trickle-down doesn't. And St. Louis prosecutor charges two reporters a year after the Ferguson protests. Now for the news.
This is the news from our side, August 13, 2015. A new International Monetary Fund study shows that trickle-down economics doesn't actually help an economy grow. That's right. The IMF has admitted that trickle-down doesn't. It only took 40 years of this disastrous austerity programs imposed on nations as diverse as the U.S., Greece, Zambia, Chile, and Russia for the IMF to finally admit that a fundamental tenet of their economic theory is a bust. That is, give to the rich in tax cuts and subsidies disguised as incentives, and those down the economic ladder will be showered with jobs and economic growth. Jim Hightower got it right years ago when he called this bogus theory trickle on. It turns out, according to Dollars and Cents magazine, the IMF used data from countries around the world to find that 1% point increase in the share of total income going to the top 20% resulted not in an increase in GDP, but a slight decrease. On the other hand, if a country defied the IMF advice and increased the income share for the bottom 20% by 1%, their economies actually rose 0.38%. Of course, labor, among other progressives, have been arguing for years that raising incomes for the wealthy does not lift all boats. They've been arguing against cutting taxes for the rich and for raising incomes for workers by raising the minimum wage and making it easier to form unions. So will the rich pay attention to this IMF study? If the pass is any indication, no. It's doubtful that even the IMF will heed its own study.
Robert E. Scott of the Economic Policy Institute has just issued a report called Manufacturing Job Loss. Trade, not productivity, is the culprit. He found that the United States lost 5 million manufacturing jobs between January 2000 and December of 2014. The reason was not, as many believe, due to the rapid productivity growth. In fact, actually, job losses can be traced to growing trade deficits in manufacturing products from 2000 to 2007, and then to the collapse of manufacturing during the Great Recession. Between 2000 and 2007, growing trade deficits in manufactured goods led to the loss of 3.6 million manufacturing jobs. Between 2007 and 2009, the massive collapse in overall U.S. output hit manufacturing particularly hard, with real manufacturing output falling to 10.3%. This collapse was followed by the slowest recovery in domestic manufacturing output in more than 60 years. Reasonably strong GDP growth over the past 5 years has not been sufficient to counter these trends. Only about 900,000 of the 2.3 million manufacturing jobs that were lost during the Great Recession have been recovered. In addition, resurgence of the U.S. trade deficit in manufactured goods since 2009 has hurt the recovery of manufacturing output and employment. In 1970, over 18 million Americans had jobs in manufacturing, and that number was relatively stable until around 2000, with productivity growth and output being roughly the same, so that the number of jobs remained the same as well. After 2000, in a period of growth trade deficits, outputs declined as we imported more jobs and more manufactured goods. The results were a prolonged collapse in manufacturing jobs. They fell to a low of 11.5 million in February of 2010 and recovered only to 12.3 million by December of 2014. Overall, manufacturing lost 5 million jobs between January 2000 and December of 2014.
A year ago, after Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson, AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka came to Missouri and told the Missouri AFL-CIO, Leslie McSpadden, Michael Brown's mother, who works in a grocery store, is our sister, an AFL-CIO union member, and Darren Wilson, the officer who killed Michael Brown, is a union member too. He is our brother. Our brother killed our sister's son, and we do not have to wait for the judgment of prosecutors or courts to tell us how terrible that is. In response to Trumka's comments, Sam Cabral, president of the International Union of Police Association, an AFL-CIO affiliate, accused Trumka of having an agenda in speaking out and wrote, "While there are those in the world that accuse all law enforcement of maintaining an us-versus-them mentality, you can bet one thing, so long as they use, as a symbol of their movement, the man who assaulted and tried to disarm a police officer who was doing his duty, I will be on the other side of that line." Police unions have long been on both sides of organized labor. While unions help professionalize police departments and end cronyism and favoritism, there is no question that police, whether union or not, break strikes, arrest picketers, and have been guilty of murdering workers in the past. Truth Out is reporting that a group of union members led by Brandon Buchanan at the University of California Davis chapter of the United Auto Workers, Local 2865, on June 25th, presented a letter to the Joint Council of his local calling on the AFL-CIO to end its affiliation with International Union of Police Associations. Historically and contemporarily, police unions serve the interests of police forces as the arm of the state, not the interests of police as laborers, the letter said. Instead, the unionization allows police to masquerade as members of working class and obfuscates their role in enforcing racism, capitalism, colonialism, and oppression of working class. The Joint Council voted to endorse the call, and the letter was sent to the AFL-CIO's leadership.
Just before the statute of limitations was due to run out, the St. Louis County Prosecutor's Office filed criminal charges against two reporters who are members of the News Guild over an incident that occurred in the wake of the shooting of Michael Brown a year ago. County Prosecutor Robert McCulloch, the guy who led off Darren Wilson, the police officer who shot Brown, charged Washington Post reporter Wesley Lowery and Huffington Post reporter Ryan Riley with trespassing on private property, a local McDonald's, and in interfering with a police officer. Upon conviction, the charges carry $1,000 fines and up to a year in jail. In a statement, News Guild CWA President Bernie Lunzer said the union joins with other outraged journalists in demanding the St. Louis County prosecutor drop the trumped-up charges against two reporters who were arrested a year ago covering the Ferguson protests. Police arrested the two on August 13, 2014, days after Brown was killed. Lowery and Riley were doing absolutely nothing wrong when police stormed the McDonald's restaurant the journalists were using for a reporting base. While attempting to comply with officers' orders to leave the restaurant, police decided they weren't acting quickly enough, Lunzer added. Initially, after slamming Lowery into a soda machine and cuffing him and treating Riley like a five-year-old, officers took them to a police station. They were held there for half an hour and then released with no charges. McCulloch filed the charges against them on August 10, 2015. His actions are a gross abuse of power and a vile assault on the First Amendment and its constitutional guarantee of freedom of the press, Lunzer said. We are not politely calling on him to drop these charges. We are demanding it. If he refuses, he will be in for the fight of his life as he faces the collective and growing wrath of journalists and free press advocates. The editors of the Washington Post and the Huffington Post also defended their reporters, who were incredulous at the prosecutor's charges. The Washington paper's legal team is planning Lowry's defense. Riley and Lowry had a bet over whether St. Louis authorities would press charges. Riley won, so now Lowry owes him a Happy Meal. Riley told CNN that the charges are a distraction from a lot of the key issues that Brown's death raised. The news tonight was read by Molly Madden, Beth Pike, Michael Savoir, and I'm Jen Zaman.
I should have known better than to yell and make a scene. I've been through this with you a few times before, and with everything you'd done and you had seen, you'd earned the right to be a little slow getting out the door. And I'm sorry that I took it out on you, all my anger up my lap in this society. But in that moment when I lost my control.
And that was Rick Palieri, "The Hardest Thing to Defeat is Hate." And we have a little unusual circumstance because our host tonight, Jake White, is got car trouble and stuck in Iowa. And he's on the phone. You there, Jake?
Hi, Judy.
Hi. And his guest is, I think, in Florida. Are you there, Brian?
Yeah, I'm in Philadelphia.
Oh, Philadelphia. Okay, Jake, can you hear Brian?
I can.
Oh, great. Well, you're good to go. I'm signing off. Have fun.
Thank you so much, Judy, for helping us out with that. And thank you, Brian, for joining us tonight. Brian J. Boley is
here.
A lawyer, a comedian, and the author of A New Financial You in 28 Days, A 37-Day Plan. Hi, Brian, and welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. It's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. A lot of adults don't know, today we're going to be talking about workplace bullying, and a lot of adults don't know that they're being bullied, and they see it as a playground phenomenon, something that maybe happened in their school days or maybe they were part of in their school days, but not something that happens to adults in the workplace. So what are some signs of workplace bullying that people can identify?
Sure. The key is the word workplace, because just as your question, makes a point of, most people, when they hear the word bullying, think of a kid beating up another kid for fun or for lunch money, or, the old ads with the muscle man beating up the skinny guy on the beach, kicking sand in his face, right? Like, that's what we think of when we think of bullying. But in the workplace, I mean, we've evolved to a point where we don't really have those things occurring in the workplace as a physical matter. But there's still the issue of power and people picking on people and the like. But it's carried out in the workplace using the tools of the workplace. A definition of workplace bullying that's commonly used is that it's repeated health-harming mistreatment of a person by one or more workers that takes the form of verbal abuse, conduct, or behaviors that are threatening, intimidating, or humiliating, sabotage that prevents work from getting done, or some combination of those things. So it could be, you know, examples could be a boss yelling at an employee, you know, repeatedly in front of other workers, or maybe with the door closed but where everybody can hear, or, you know, nitpicking on work, setting unreasonable deadlines, giving heavy workloads, spreading gossip about somebody. It can also be groups of workers shunning another worker, for example, or gossiping about somebody. But it's usually a repeated, very malicious act. It doesn't really have anything to do with the work. It has to do with underlying power struggles in the workplace.
People might think, oh, this is, you know, I'm not supposed to like work, or, you know, people are supposed to be rough on each other at work or things like that. So would you say a lot of workplace bullying situations are sort of like the frog in the boiling water kind of thing, where you don't really notice it at first and then it gets worse, but you just ignore it?
That's an excellent analogy because, yeah, a lot of people don't know they're being bullied. I know this sounds strange, but people might just think, just like you said, like, I don't like work, or work is difficult. And they may, on a Sunday evening, feel that, like, what I call the sick, you know, the sick Sunday feeling, you know, before you have to go into work Monday. And a lot of people think it's just, hey, I don't like my job, or my boss is a jerk, or my coworkers are nasty, you know, they act like school kids or something. But often these people are being bullied, and one way to tell if you're being bullied is to sort of look at that kind of behavior and also look at how you feel. Do you have that dread feeling? Are you suffering from stress issues? Is this job perhaps different from other jobs that you've had, you know, where you just feel worse? You feel you can't measure up. This boss is always on you. So many conscientious people don't know they're being bullied. They just think that, hey, maybe I'm not measuring up. Maybe I'm not doing enough. I have to do more. You know, it's my fault. So a lot of people don't know it because, again, the term bullying makes us think of the schoolyard. And also, a lot of the victims, you know, the studies show that probably most of the victims are women, but a lot of the victims are actually men. And I think that men underreport because, A, they don't know they're being bullied. You know, they think of it as a physical thing, and they don't see themselves as the kind of person who gets bullied. So it's really the last thing on their mind. They might think their boss is, you know, trying to use tough love or something, or their boss is just difficult or has high standards. So there you go.
And we see, you know, there's maybe more shows than ever in pop culture that are about the workplace and about how people get along in the workplace. And one of the most popular ones and something that's on right now is the NFL Hard Knocks program. And we know mm-hmm. a lot about the, you know, like hazing rookies or making them pay for dinner and things like that. And people have talked about, you know, at what point does that become, you know, unacceptable. And I was just wondering, how much do you think that shows like that sort of influence how people behave in the workplace, or what people find acceptable workplace behavior?
Yeah, well, those shows, I think, do have an unfortunate effect of making light of it sometimes, making it look like it's entertaining, or making it look like it's part and parcel of the culture. Football is a great example. You know, a lot of men played football more. Yeah, you know, I think women, girls are playing now, but it's mostly men. And, you know, you spent your youth getting yelled at by a coach, like getting hazed by the seniors when you're a freshman and sophomore. But I think the point where it becomes, you know, I think that there's some of that that's just always going to be part of our culture, like it or not. But I think that where it starts to get to a point where the victim, you know, where it becomes more malicious, where the victim is actually, you know, really suffering from it. Like, what if, you know, if a freshman on a football team or a rookie in the NFL has to pay for dinner, it might be like, okay, whatever, next year my dinner gets paid for. But if it's like here, you're paying for dinner for everyone, and we over-ordered, you know, like where it becomes really abusive and becomes more about a power relationship than about getting the job done. I think that then you really start to veer into the world of bullying.
If everyone gets a bottle of wine at dinner or something like that.
Yeah, like something that's really just a real abuse and then kind of a nasty laughing at, ha-ha, you're stuck with our, you know, $3,600 dinner bill, ha-ha. You know, something like that, you know, where it's not good-natured, but the laughter is a sort of, there's an edge to it, I think.
To stick with the NFL analogy, I think, you know, some of the, there's definitely discrimination based on age and experience, and then there's also, you know, people are competing with each other for jobs and for promotions. So how much does workplace competition influence bullying?
Yeah, that's a good point, too. Like, say in the NFL, people are competing, and if someone's bullying of, say, a rookie, really was to hurt that rookie and make it so that he couldn't perform well, you know, in, you know, a sabotaging of his performance, I think that would be workplace bullying. And then in the regular workplace, this surprises a lot of people, that very often the people who are bullied are the stars, are people who are doing a really good job. Very often a boss, this is kind of inherent to bullying. The boss has the power and feels threatened by some employee beneath him or her. Maybe that employee is more technically savvy. Maybe that employee is actually better at the job than the boss, or appears that he might be soon. Maybe that employee is more popular among other employees. And very often the boss will feel threatened by that and then will, you know, dump work on the person or yell at the person, nitpick, you know, tell the person he's not measuring up, you know, precisely to destabilize that person because that person poses a threat. So it's often, you know, when we talk about the schoolyard bullying, we're talking very much about the physically stronger taking on the physically weaker, but in the workplace, it's the person who's more power, and it might be the skinny, wimpy guy with, you know, the pencil neck, he's a geek, he's the boss, and he might be bullying the, you know, very fit, muscular guy working beneath him, you know, because, again, it's about power more than anything.
Is this a phenomenon that's unique to the United States? Or
no,
is this something that other countries have done a better job taking care of?
Yeah, other countries actually have laws against this in some shape or form. The United States actually is unique in that right now there's no state, and under federal law, there's no way to get redress for, you know, legally for pure bullying. Instead, what you have to do in the United States is tie the bullying into a legally actionable form of discrimination like gender, race, national origin, religion, disability, sexual orientation, something like that. But just everyday bullying not based on those categories, there's no redress for it in the United States, you know, as far as states and the federal government go. But in other countries, the Scandinavian countries, the EU countries, and several jurisdictions in Canada, you can actually bring a legal action against somebody. In Australia, I think, as well, you can bring a legal action against somebody who's bullying you at work.
And just to clarify for our listeners, we're talking about only stuff that's going on between employees at a certain organization, not like if you take someone's, you know, glass too soon, if you're a waiter or something like that.
Yeah, that wouldn't be like there's a bill, and listeners can go to this website and read about it. It's called the Healthy Workplace Bill. They actually don't have the text of the bill, but there's a bill, and this site talks about it. The bullying would have to be repeated. It would have to be, you know, very vicious. The victim has to have psychological harm from it, or even, you know, physical illness harms from it, because in the commercial world, there is a fear that, you know, if this ever became illegal, right, bullying, that people would, you know, cite all these little slights and harms and problems as bullying. So it's actually a fairly tough standard to meet, you know, for the bullying. Like, it has to be that kind of repeated action. There has to be the damages against, you know, the damages from the victim and the like. So that's something, you know, given, you know, to respond to the issue about the waiter. But I think that bullying can actually occur. You know, an employer could allow, for example, an employee to be bullied by customers. So say if you're at a law firm and you have a client, and the client is bullying, you know, a lower down lawyer, you know, perhaps, it depends what the law would look like, that could be actionable against the employer for allowing that. Or think of an airline where they put, you know, the airline customer relations people at the desk, and customers are, you know, forever treating the people very nastily. There could be instances, perhaps, where, you know, the employer could be liable for allowing the third parties to bully the employee. But again, the law is not passed anywhere, and that would have to be written into the law. But I could see that being there.
What actions can activists, organizers, labor, people who are interested in healthy workplaces, what actions can they take? Can you repeat the name of that website and maybe give us a little more information about it?
Yeah, definitely. There are two websites that I heartily recommend. The first, and it's easier just to Google this, is it's called the Workplace Bullying Institute, and that's the best place to start to learn all about it, and even what to do if you're being bullied, for example. There's another site called the HealthyWorkplaceBill.org, but people can Google Healthy Workplace Bill, and that website actually has, you know, a section that says, what can I do to help? And it gives people ways where they can work with, you know, if there's a state coordinator in their state, they can work with that person to help the bill get introduced in the legislature, for example. If there is no state coordinator, they could sign up to become that state coordinator. If people are in unions, they should try to educate union members about it. And some unions have, in fact, fairly recently in Massachusetts, the Service Employees Union International and the National Association of Government Employees, so the SEIU/NAGE, they negotiated with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and got in the new contract a quote-unquote mutual respect provision. So that would allow for, you know, union members to, you know, grieve for incidents of bullying, and that's something that union members can do. Unfortunately, not very many American employees are unionized right now, but that's certainly something they can do. And the other thing to do is to try to spread information about it, you know, try to talk to people about it. There's, again, at the Healthy Workplace Bill site, there's some information can be printed off, for example. And I think that the more we talk about this, even greater in some ways than creating a law, though I want to see a law against this, we create a norm, an understanding that, hey, this is not good to do to people at work. This is not appropriate. This is not how people should treat each other at the workplace. And I think we're able to create norms against domestic violence, norms against smoking. I think that once we start talking about workplace bullying and bring it out of the shadows, I think the more we're going to be able to do to stop it.
Mm-hmm. And one last question for you, sort of a speculative question, your opinion, but a lot of major liberal policymakers have been talking about raising the minimum wage, possibly up to $15 or so. Do you think that that kind of wage increase might lead to more workplace bullying, maybe people being told, like, oh, you don't deserve this new wage, or you need to work extra hard now that you're making more money, or anything like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I think that a lot of the bullying comes from individuals, you know, bosses who feel threatened, for example, by an employee doing better. So that probably wouldn't contribute to it. If an employer wants employees to quit, they will often allow for bullying or have more widespread bullying of employees. So I don't know. That is a really good question. Not sure the answer. I would say I can't think of anything on the spot. You know, we should try to still push for a better minimum wage.
Yeah, I agree with you. And for a calmer and less bullied workplace. So both good goals to have.
Absolutely. It's
Thank
more
you so
oh,
much
the other
for joining
thing
us
I say
today,
is there's
Brian.
A lot of these websites and advocates and people like me talk about the the business case against bullying. It actually cuts down on productivity. It causes good people, like think of the good employee who threatens his boss, you know, whom the boss is threatened by, that very often the victims of bullying quit, or very often if people, you know, sense that the boss might be threatened by them, they may not do as well at work, and, you know, they might spend time, you know, trying to get out, and or they might be suffering from the stress illnesses that bullying, you know, helps cause, and there you get a cut in productivity, a more toxic workplace, you get a bad reputation for the workplace. So it's bad business as well. The only people bullying helps, and I put that in quotes, is the particular bullies who are somehow enjoying it or getting pleasure out of it. But it doesn't help the workplace. It doesn't create better workers. It doesn't create better work. And, you know, it's everyone other than the bullies has an interest in getting rid of them.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you so much for joining us today, Brian, and have a good rest of your evening.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Philadelphia. And hopefully we will be going back to Kansas City soon. Anyone in Kansas City wants to pick up?
All right, super.
So much. All right, thank you.
Okay,
bye.
Bye-bye. Take care.
We sold the clothes, the clothes that you buy. We can't afford them for ourselves, the price is too high. Our families need food, we don't need name brands.
Edition of Every Woman at 3 p.m. here on 90.1 FM KKFI. Esther Hulzendorf and Dave Kingsley will discuss the plight of the elderly on Kansas City's East Side. Join us for this enlightening discussion as we delve into the issues our aging population is facing. That's Every Woman, Saturdays at 3 p.m. on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Some history on the struggle for contraception on Wings, Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
That was No Sweat with Bev Grant and Pat Humphreys. Good evening. I'm Jan Brill, a volunteer here at Heartland Labor Forum. And tonight we have in our studio Scott Schifullo, an AFT member and past president, statewide president of the AFT, taught in the Kansas City schools, an elementary school, for 22 years, and is currently the AFT member services coordinator. And he's going to talk to us about bullying in the educational setting. Thank you so much for coming, Scott.
Thank you for having me.
Here it is a new school year, and we're talking about bullying, but a different kind of bullying than we usually talk about. Can you give us an idea of bullying suffered by educators in the workplace?
Yeah, sure. First of all, I have to say I've been retired for a year, and it was the result of bullying. And so when the back-to-school ads came on as I was laying on my couch this last week, I was pretty relieved I wasn't going back for particular reasons. There are many, many ways that an administrator can bully a teacher. One of the ways is they can stack your class. There's a lot of times when you as teachers split the classes up according to different reading levels, math levels, gender stuff, to get a complete class, and then the principal can come in and say, well, you know, I think he could handle him. I think we'll put this person in that class. So you can have basically a class with high achievers and no behavior problems, or you can have the opposite. That's one of the ways. The other way is piling deadlines on you, changing deadlines on you, changing grade levels. That happened to me. I'm basically a first grade teacher, and hadn't taught fifth grade in 30 years, and I was put in a fifth grade classroom. So those are some of the ways. Coming in and out of your classroom 8 to 10 times a day and then writing you up because you didn't do or say one thing particularly that they, you know, thought was wrong or didn't want to hear. So those are just some of the general ways that in the education system bullying occurs.
Has this high-stakes testing increased bullying in your view?
Well, yes, it has, and it's probably, I'm trying to think of the word, decreased student achievement along the way, especially school systems that have lost their accreditation or are on provisional accreditation. There are high stakes involved there, and when you have to come up with a certain percentage of test scores, you take away the joy of learning, and you're told what to teach, you're told what not to teach. I was told one year to not teach my fifth graders social studies. So for an entire year, my children did not get social studies because that was not a tested subject. And one of the days that I did try to teach social studies, principal came in, and I was verbally chastised in her office. Of course, nothing would be in writing because, hey, you know, I should have been teaching social studies, so yeah.
There was a time, as a retired social studies teacher, there was a time when the primary reason for public education was to create good, knowledgeable citizens, but not anymore, huh?
No, and I'll be honest. I feel sorry, obviously, for the teachers, but the children, they have no creativity anymore. If you're doing things to further the lesson and have fun with it, those things now are, in a lot of places, are discouraged and frowned upon, and you will be looked at and treated differently for doing those things.
You've mentioned being forbidden to teach social studies and changing in grades. I understand you have personal experience with bullying. Were there other times when you were bullied?
Yes, actually, a year ago. I was teaching. I'm basically a first grade teacher. Most of my years have been first grade. When I came back from doing my tenure as a state president, I decided to go back in the classroom. I was giving a first grade kindergarten split. Now, if there's any teachers out there, it takes a special person to be a kindergarten teacher, let alone somebody to teach kindergarten and first grade at the same time. It was a great disservice to the children, and it obviously was a great disservice to me. I think it was interesting because that job was held open, I believe, because really I don't think there were a lot of principals going, oh, I'll take the president of the union of the state. Yeah, have him come to my building. And that was the way, that was the first part, okay? Second year, I'm in first grade. I think it was October. Principal called me. I had a lady show up at my door and said, I'm going to sub for you. Please come down to the office. The principal wants to talk to you. And she asked me if I would be interested in teaching fifth grade. And I politely said, no, you know, I appreciate it, but I like my first graders. Well, the next day when I came in, she was waiting at my door before I unlocked it and said, you'll have 5 minutes to tell your kids goodbye. You're going to fifth grade. Okay, well, fifth grade was, we had two fifth grades at the time. I, of course, being the new person on the block, my class was heavily stacked with behavior problems, and I mean children who would drop language that would even make me raise my eyebrow. I was breaking up fights. I was assaulted twice. All the time, when you would go through the code of conduct and try to minimize the disruption for the children that were there behaving and wanting to participate in class, I would send the kids to the office with the proper referral. They would come back and they would be eating a candy bar or drinking a soda an hour later, kind of grinning as they came in at me. During the course of the year, you go, I can relate it to when I was in school and I had a bad teacher. I can remember from the time I got out on school on Friday, by Sunday morning, I'm trying to think of what kind of illness I can do to stay home. Except as an adult, the illness started to become real. And that's one of the things that bullying has an effect on you, not only relationships, but your health. And so I really was thinking about how do I do this. I mean, we're halfway through the year and I'm not wanting to go to school. And I'd never been in that situation before. I've always enjoyed teaching and I've always had support doing it. Well, I ended up going to my doctor and had to be put on prescription to make it through the school year. With that, I wanted my principal to know what she was doing to me, even if she didn't, you know, think she was doing anything bad. So I went into her office and I put my pills on her desk and I said, this is what you're doing. You know, I have to medicate myself to teach children because of the dysfunction here at the top. Well, you know, that went over real well. At a follow-up visit with my doctor before the end of the year, I credit her. She's the one who really convinced me by just sitting down talking with her that retirement would be the best option for me. Because my principal had already told me that I was going to teach sixth grade next year. Well, that's half of the children that I had battled in fifth grade I was going to get back. And after talking to her, I put in my retirement. It's sad. I never thought it would ever come to that because of the joy I have for teaching. But my relationships at home and my health were more important.
So you blame the bullying you received in the workplace for your early retirement from teaching?
Oh, definitely. You know, there's different things that go on with bullying, you know, coming in your classroom all the time, making everything's not right. You know, you turn in your lesson plans. Oh, you really need to do these over. This is not what I want. I think one of the biggest things that I learned, though, through this experience is the isolation. You know, schools are a lot like churches. That kind of everybody knows what everybody's doing, you know. And once people found out that I was not, you know, I was standing up for myself, you know, people wouldn't come to my room to talk to me. And I felt like I was going through this all alone. And once I was able to talk to some other teachers to see what was going on with them, some of the same things were going on with them. In fact, I won't mention the school, but the school had a half of their staff turned over the next year.
Wow.
Yeah. Now I'm off that medication. I don't have that stress. You know, and the stress wasn't children. The stress wasn't teaching. It was somebody coming after your job. And I think what you do is, okay, you take it, and then you go, you know what? Enough's enough.
And we lose a good teacher.
Yeah, exactly.
This is Heartland Labor Forum, 90.1 KKFI Community Radio. I'm Jan Brill, and we're visiting with Scott Cifullo, who is an AFT teacher who is talking to us about bullying in the workplace in an educational setting. How widespread is this kind of bullying, do you think?
Oh, I think it's very widespread. I just read something recently, not pertaining particularly to education, but talking about how 54 million people have been at one time or another bullied in their jobs. That's a staggering number.
And you feel it's similar in the educational setting?
Oh, of course. You know, of course. It's interesting because as I was going through this experience, my wife, who works in the corporate world, had gone through some experiences. And the only good thing that came out of that is I was able to talk to her about what I was going through. So I think one of the key things is finding somebody you can talk to, either a good friend, a family member, or a health professional.
That leads to the next question. What resources are available for those who suffer bullying at their jobs and schools?
Well, you can always go to your administrator. The problem is that most of the time it's that administrator that is doing the bullying. Not always. A lot of times it comes to another staff member bullying. But you have to be careful because when you do that, whether you do it in a school setting with an administrator or in the corporate world, you can't believe that the principal will be your friend and help you, nor can you believe HR is going to be your friend. I always take the union approach with, and I think it's good for anybody who works outside of education, is when you communicate to your principal or to the HR about an issue like this, do it in writing. Never do it verbal. Do it in writing and maybe end it with a question so you have something coming back to you. And I think that's very important. We learn in the AFT world to document.
So do you see the principal as the primary source of bullying in most school settings, or is it higher up than that?
No, I see it a lot as the principal or the vice principal under the direction of the principal. Usually higher up, it the tone is set at the building.
I think our listeners ought to understand that when you're certified as a teacher, your certification may be K through six.
Right.
I was high school, so I was English social studies. Any class that you're certified to teach, you are required to teach if asked. Is that not correct?
Yes, that is correct. And in fact, you know, people say, well, why don't you just transfer out? Well, I tried that, trust me, and that went nowhere. When you're assigned to teach, you sign that just initial contract, and they can put you in any building in any grade that you're certified to teach. Like, for instance, I'm K through 8 with a lifetime certificate. Thank goodness I never had to teach 8th. But
So when you expressed a desire not to teach the upper elementary, was any weight given to that at all in your experience?
No. What's interesting about that is I was asked, and a friend of mine who was involved in the Teach for America program was asked. But it was the 20-year veteran that got put in the class and not the young Teach for America person, which that in itself I found insulting.
So the kind of a seniority system, it's an odd sort of effect in schools then.
Well, it does. I mean, seniority is good as far as, you know, callback and your job, but it doesn't cross over into where they place you. Seniority would have no place in that, even though it should, because if you look, I was in the district at that time for 20 years. Well, I had already shown a commitment to the district. A lot of the Teach for America people, and I think it's a great program, I'm not saying that, it's that those teachers will do a few years and then they go on. So you don't get that investment like you do with someone who's been there a while.
So from your view, I guess it's a two-part question, what do you think teachers can do about the situation, and what can the general public do, for example, patrons of a school system, do to help teachers that are bullied in this way?
Well, first, if you have an option or the opportunity to join a union, I would do so, okay? Trying to get language into your union contract is a very good way to stop this. I recently went down to the Boot Heel to represent a lady that was bullied by a principal, and they had no language in their board documents addressing this. You know, most of the language you see anymore, there's no federal language, but most of the language you see in the states is about bullying a child or a student. But we're lacking on the other end. So I would suggest that trying to negotiate contract language, and then therefore you would be able to grieve it and would have some teeth. If you're outside the education world and don't have the opportunity to join a union, I would say you document everything. You go to your HR, but always, you know, keep one ear open, because you need to trust your HR, and sometimes that might not be possible.
What about the parents of children whose teacher is being bullied? Do they have any leverage at all?
You know, it doesn't get to that point usually until the teacher is removed, okay, or, you know, some kind of scandal where parents get out and get their fight on to save a teacher. I mean, most of that stuff is kept, you know, undercover in the school that nobody else knows about it.
Well, I'd just like to say I'm very sorry that our school system has lost a dedicated teacher like you to an issue like bullying. And I hope our listeners take note that there is teacher bullying of teachers, appears to be rampant in our country. Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Shifulo.
I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to share my story. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Stay tuned, please, for the calendar.
Canvassing to Sustain Right to Work Veto by Jay Nixon. Wednesday evenings and Saturdays until mid-September, that's when the veto session is. To sign up for locations, call Kansas City Jobs with Justice, 816-753-0689. Wyandotte County Third Saturday Democratic Breakfast, Saturday, August 15th, 8:15 for breakfast, 9:15 for speaker. That's at Las Islas Marias, 7516 State Avenue. Kansas City Democratic Party Chairman Larry Meeker will be the speaker. Workers' Rights Clinic for Victims of Wage Theft, Monday, August 17th, 5 to 8 p.m., El Centro, 650 Minnesota Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. Nurses picket to support a decent contract at Research Hospital. That'll be Thursday, August 20th, 5 to 8 p.m. That's Research Medical Center, 2316 East Meyer Boulevard, Kansas City, Missouri, 64132, near Prospect and Meyer.
Okay, and that was Molly Madden with the calendar, and you can find our calendar on our website at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also find archived shows and our upcoming schedule. And I just want to take a couple of minutes to talk about Women's Equality Week, which is coming up the week of August 23rd. And Women's Equality Week is an expansion of Women's Equality Day, August 26th, the day in 1920 when the 19th Amendment was ratified, giving women the right to vote. During the week, an ad hoc coalition of organizations, agencies, and media offer programs on the issues that prevent women from achieving full equality. Each organization, based on its mission, educates, inspires, and encourages women and men to advocate, lead, and especially to use the power of the vote to obtain full equality for women. Programs are free and open to the public, and I just want to feature a couple of them. One of the star speakers is going to be Jessica Newworth, who will be speaking at the Kansas City Public Library on August 20. Well, wait a minute here. I will find that. August 26th from 6 to 8 p.m. Her talk is called Equal Means Equal, Why the Time for Equal Rights, the Week on Equal Rights Act is Now. And she is the founder of Equality Now, director of New York Office on the UN High Commission on Human Rights. And so that's Wednesday, August 26th at 6 o'clock. There are also a number of programs starting on Sunday, the 23rd, when there'll be a program called Reflections on Black Women on the Civil Rights Movement. And that's a presentation by Ina Montgomery. It's going to be at UMKC Hague Hall, room 313, from 3 to 4:30 p.m. on Sunday, the 23rd. On Monday, there's going to be a program called Struggling in the Land of Opportunity, a First-Person Perspective, dinner and presentation at St. Paul's Episcopal Church, 40th and Main Street, at 6 to 8 p.m. And also programs at 6:30, Women as Leaders with former KCMO Mayor Kay Barnes, former Kansas Insurance Commissioner Sandy Prager, and Heart Song KC Women's Chorus. All Souls, UU Church, 4501 Walnut, and sponsored by a whole bunch of organizations. Anyway, there is a webpage with all of the events for Women's Equality Week. You can find it on Facebook, actually. Just look up Women's Equality GKC, and you can find this schedule. That's it for tonight's show. Be sure to tune in next week. We're going to be talking with Reverend William Barber on his about a talk he gave a couple months ago called America Lacks Heart. And we're also going to have a segment called Badass Teachers Unite, just in time for school to start. Thanks to our engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI.